Welcome to everyone who is watching on the YouTube channel today in this video or listening on our podcast for Lattice Training. In this episode, we have Stian Christofferson, who is a physiotherapist, professional climbing coach. He is a coach for the Norwegian national team, also a very experienced climber athlete himself. And is decorated with some pretty good competition results over the years. And he has recently come into the, the climbing public space through the release of what has been called the 9C climbing test, and is also the co-author of an amazing climbing book called The Climbing Bible with his friend and partner in all things climbing, Martin Morbratten. So welcome to the show, Stian. Really looking forward to getting into chatting all sorts of things here. Can you just give the listeners and watchers just a brief intro into your background as a climber and a coach?
Sure. Thanks, Tom. I'm a climber first and foremost. I started climbing when I was, about 13, and climbed a lot. Outside, did a lot of competitions up to the start of my 20s. Moved to France with Martin, stayed there for a year and a half, just climbing all the time. Came back, did my physiotherapy education in Norway, finished that in 2007 and 8. Been working in private practice ever since, going more and more into climbing, obviously treating climbing-related injuries. Still doing that. I started coaching the Norwegian national team in 2011 did that out the year of 2015. And during that time, I also did elite coach education through the Norwegian Olympic Sports Center and the Norwegian School of Sports Science. And I'm still coaching athletes, not through the federation, but more on a private basis that compete internationally. So now I'm combining physiotherapy in private practice with coaching and also writing these books, as you talked about, The Climbing Bible, and with all future books and plans together with Martin.
Ah, brilliant. Well, that sets us up absolutely perfectly. So let's dive into the interview. Let's kick this discussion off, Stian, with and you know, the topic of today is really talking about performance profiling, the 9C test that we saw recently come out as being, you know, it's really blown up. Loads of people are talking about it. We saw Magnus doing it, we saw a load of really famous climbers getting on it. So we're really into performance profiling, but can you tell us a bit about the history and where this test came from your end? How did it all come about? What's the story?
Well, I guess the story goes back a long time. We had I had test results for Magnus from when I coached the Norwegian national team, we also talked about making a YouTube episode with him. So my initial idea was to test him again and then see if he was performing at the same level as he was 7 years ago when he was competing in the World Cups. And then we discussed it some more, and we wanted to try and make sort of a test battery that was really easy for people to do at home, especially now during the lockdown, that didn't require any sort of additional equipment besides some extra weights. So that was the tests, and I don't think like the tests in themselves are very new. So the test battery in combination was maybe something new. And then, of course, what really blew up more than we could think of was the grade conversion and the scoring, which really kicked it. So
what were the tests? Just for anyone listening who hasn't seen the video, and hasn't seen what you're doing the test, what were the tests that you actually gave to Magnus in this particular one?
We wanted to test finger strength. So we did weighted dead hangs for 5 seconds. We did sort of like finger strength / finger endurance, just hanging off a bar. We did upper body strength with the weighted pull-ups. and we did core strength, which was a progression ladder from sort of an L-sit into a full front lever. So that was trying to break down the physical performance factors that that are important for climbing, for performance. So finger strength, obviously, pulling strength for the arms and upper body, and then also core strength. So definitely has its limitations. And I also think that it's good that it sparked the interest that we could do sort of like this speculation in grades and see how they add up. So I guess that's what you want to talk about, right?
Yeah, I mean, did Magnus ask you to come up with a grade conversion scale? And it was the scenario that you had some of these tests that you were doing with Magnus in the past and with other climbers, and that the whole grading scale matrix didn't exist, but you had to do it essentially for the purposes of the video?
Yeah, more or less. Yeah, so we discussed it back and forth for a while, and like from a scientific point of view, it's like, no, we can't do this because we don't have the data set and this is like speculations. And then we started to think about it some more and like, all right, but we've coached some very good climbers, we know some very good climbers, we actually have some reference points, and sort of like how much weight can you hang on from this size of an edge, etc.
Was it 20 mil edge as well that you were doing?
Yeah.
But was it 20 mil edge that you were using?
Yeah, but we used the woodies in our gym. So, and that's also important to bring across, like when you, if you try to standardize something the way you've done with the lattice board or with the lattice rung, then it would be easier to compare. But for us, it's easy to compare in our gym. Like we just used that size of a rung.
Yeah.
So yeah, we took some of these reference points and tried to make a score that seemed feasible, and then just added up a scoring system to see how we could make this work. And then I guess after maybe 3 years of collecting data, we would be closer. So this was more like just a test, and also something obviously for Magnus to give to his viewers. But it definitely sparked some interest.
Yeah. So I guess in many ways you were quite pressured in the way that you had to pull something out of the bag to give to Magnus for his viewers. And I know that if I was in a similar situation, and you know, you and Martin do a lot of really good quality work. And when you have to put something out to the general public, especially if you know that some of them may not be very elite level climbers, or perhaps just, you know, CrossFitters or people that like general conditioning, it's a bit of a funny thing, isn't it, to have to try and do?
Yeah, it's fucking scary. I mean, it's like, it was like this when we wrote the climbing Bible, like to publish it in Norway as well. I'm a physiotherapist, and I've also done higher education in coaching, and very used to reading scientific papers and using references, etc. And then trying to write something without references all the time, and then going out public, doing something that, you know, are a bit more speculative, but then again, a lot more fun. And also that's why we ended up doing it, basically, was that, all right, this is a fun way to spark some interest into testing. We anticipated that it would be sort of like a bias in participation. So you get a selection bias in the tests, because is all the climbers or athletes that are physically strong already would be the first one to jump on that kind of test. So we anticipated that the test would go wrong in like where people got a higher grade than they could actually climb, which we thought was, well, maybe that's okay. I think also that climbing and training for climbing has gone more and more into the worlds of physical factors over the years. So it's increasingly popular with all the different training methods for finger strength, etc. So people spend a lot of time like improving those 2% in dead hangs, but they still really don't know how to climb. So that's why you get a higher grade on a test score like that. So it opens up for a discussion, like, all right, if you perform better on a physical test than you're actually climbing, then where should you put your focus?
Yeah, it definitely opens up a lot of discussion. And like one thing that I've seen over the last, you know, like must be 2 weeks or so, where we've just been constantly tagged in things. And I'm like always getting people like sending me DMs and saying, what's up with this? I got this score here. I don't know how to interpret this. Is that it gets people into a point where they're actually starting to think about their own climbing and their performance and starting to question why they're seeing these scores or how they relate to these tests. And even if you have a test kit, which might not be perfect, or it might have actually a deeply uncorrelated relationship with your climbing, is it, you know, in the first instance actually gets you to go back and question yourself and go, actually, has this test made me realize finally that I am way stronger than I need to be? Or has it actually made me realize that I've been relying on technique and mental skills for the last 10 weeks? And really, I should actually maybe get on with some sort of formal structured training. And I've just been avoiding it for the last decade. It starts to highlight those things, doesn't it? Even in a fun sense.
Yeah, I think so. It definitely does. And I think many climbers will improve so much by just structuring a bit. Like so many climbers just go to the gym and they climb as hard as they can for as long as they can on the things that they find the most fun, which is basically what makes up climbing. Like it's a brilliant sport. But when it comes to improving, you need to structuralize it a bit more. And it's very easy to structuralize the quantifiable factors. So everything you can measure seems to add very well to people. It makes sense to like add another kilo or add another second or add another set. Whereas like, how do you really quantify your footwork on vertical terrain above a bolt? Like that's so much harder to do. And maybe it has something to do as well with people coming into climbing from other sports. So they're more used to measuring things. But it's like with these tests and all the data, I wish we come to a point in climbing where we have data. Like you've done an amazing job over the last years gathering all the data for on finger strength, for instance. So like say we make it to Premier League status, right? So for a midfielder in Premier League, you would know approximately how fast he would run on a 40 meter sprint dash, how high he would jump, and how fast he could run a Cooper test. And then you could test that and you can see, all right, you have the physical capacity to perform midfield Premier League, but you still don't know how you handle the ball. So you could be a shit football player still, but you have the physical capacity to be a Premier League midfielder. And I think that's, if you can take the physical factors and say that, well, I'm basically outperforming myself on these things, so maybe I should go and try and do something else. And then start, like you say, to think about it. Like if I have really strong fingers and I want to train technique, then I better make the holds really poor. So I can't use that finger strength all the time. So I have to use the technique and move my body in a different way. And the same goes with if you're still really afraid of moving half a meter above a bolt, then it doesn't really matter how strong you are. You'd still be terrified.
Yeah. I always tell people that if you can't even do stuff like operate on the end of a rope and be above a bolt, you're probably going to lose, depending on how scared you are, potentially up to 3 grades.
Yeah.
Depending on how scared you are. So what's the point in all that training if you're terrified?
Yeah, and you could say that, all right, you get stronger, so you get more confident and you can do the moves more controlled. But I rarely find that people get more scared if they can't really do the move. Like they're equally scared. And I remember that from when I started climbing. Like I would be scared nonetheless. I would maybe be less scared if my focus was so into the climbing that I didn't really think about the height. But that's sort of like an exposure thing. So you just have to do it more. So I don't think that just training and getting fitter would make that so much easier. You would have to go and expose yourself to those situations to actually improve.
Yeah.
So I think that was one of the reasons why we ended up doing it, even though it was scary going out doing something very unscientific to a viewer base, which just you can't really imagine 1 million people looking at that test. That would be like, yeah, then we wouldn't be able to do nothing. So we just had to go for it. And It's like for higher level climbers, it seems to be surprisingly accurate to some point. Like it's not that off. Even if I test myself, it's pretty accurate, even though I know it's not. So, but I think it gets increasingly more difficult to like make the grades right the further down you go. I don't know what your experience is with that when you test your clients.
I think like in terms of like profiling tests, and this we can talk about this in a second, is it's about selecting the right tests, making them be appropriate to the specialization that you're working with. And then of course some weighting and how you deal with the kind of the models and statistical models that are associated with them. But I think there are certain tests that you have where you will see, even if in your logical head you go, this will relate well to climbing, is unfortunately, it just won't. You won't get a correlation. You won't get a Straden pattern of get this factor here, measure it from a potential of 1 through to a maximum score of 100, and then map that against grade, whether it's route climbing or bouldering. You just won't see a relationship, even though you might think it's logical. And there's a classic example of this is that we spent at least 2 years at Lattice collecting data on continuous dead hangs at 60%. So we had a dead hang that you would carry out for continuous. So you would just hold this edge, 20 mil edge, continuously until you'd fall off. And we must have, and it was a good 2 years in which we collected that data. Because in my mind, I thought there was some logic that there might be some correlation with performance, especially because I'd seen all those leaderboards with the slag board.
Yeah, slag boards.
For a while, and I was like, this is cool. I mean, we should collect some data on it and see what happens with it. But after a couple of years, we just, you know, like a proper good look through it all, and there just wasn't any correlation. I mean, it was very, very vague, like as in basically useless. But then there are other tests which, so for example, like max pull-up tests, which you might do 1 rep max, 2 rep max, 5 rep max, and those will have a correlation with climbing performance, but it will be a broader one. And the degree of error that you have across that, you know, that line of regression that you get through the models will be much, much wider. And we've also found that to some degree, some of those tests stop being a predictor or a correlation with performance when you get to certain values. So it's almost like the ability to pull hard with lats, back, shoulders is really relevant to climbing until you get to this level, in which case every extra 10% that you achieve on this score just doesn't translate back into climbing because you're way over the demands of the sport. Whereas stuff like finger strength, hip flexibility have really good tidy correlations, especially if you start combining them and building models, like multi-factor models, back into climbing. So it's like, it's that test selection thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it would be great, like to have these test batteries and then have loads and loads of people going through them and then see where are the correlations. Like if you do this test and you score this, then you're probably climbing on a higher level, which is cool because we get the comparison and we can compare ourselves with others, which is useful, I guess, like with your data set for the national teams and elite athletes. It's always good to see like, all right, how do I measure up against these and these? But I would guess like for the male elite or the female elite for that matter, you would still have competitors that are very, very equal, in like equal competitors. They perform maybe at the same level between 15th and 5th in the World Cups, and it wouldn't be that much of a difference, would it? Like not massively, no. So then again, like the tests are basically for you, or as if you're a coach, they're a tool for you and your client or you and your team, so you can measure progress and maybe less comparison to others and less correlation with grades, which obviously are both those two things are way funnier than measuring your own progress, obviously. But that's where the true value lies.
I know. I always think it's an interesting thing because you basically got this tool that, you know, coaches, sports scientists will use in the work that they do on a daily basis, whether it's with their own, you know, private individuals or with national teams. And it's a tool. But when we bring this back into the kind of the wider world, and especially if it gets a lot of legs and gets seen by a lot of people, is that you end up with these very human kind of emotional reactions to things like performance, like profiling. And you want to kind of like hold it off and go, no, I just want this in the sports science world because I know how to use it in this atmosphere.
Yeah.
It also has such a good use back with the general population. But we have to accept that people sometimes just kind of like slightly get the wrong end of the stick or take away conclusions where they go, I looked at my scores and it said I was an 8B plus climber. I'm not an 8B plus climber. This test is a load of crap.
Yeah.
Pointless. And they want to like throw it out because it's like a really emotional connection with the thing.
Yeah, it is.
Realizing it's not profiling. Performance profiling is not a descriptor of who you are.
No.
So, you know, I think, performer.
And I think that's a very important issue. Like these tests, even if we had tests for like perfect climbing technique, it would still just be a tool to profile where are your gaps. And I think we're kind of used to doing that with elite athletes. Like, all right, you have this level in, for example, finger strength. So if we were to improve that by 2 or 3%, you would have to use this much time approximately to get there. So, and that would be a lot of time because that's like the really high hanging fruit. That's where you have your strength. So would it be better to use that time elsewhere? So like on the mental capacities, how do you handle stress in competition situations, all of these things that could be more valuable. And that's where like, that's how you build a profile basically. So the physical tests are just one part of profiling.
Yeah.
But they tell you quite a bit. And it is emotional. Like I send people to your tests, like the home tests. Mm-hmm. And I talked to them later and they were like, yeah, they just basically told me I was shit. So I was like, yeah, how did they tell you were shit? No, I was way stronger than what I can climb. So it's like, I'm strong, but I climb shit. And like, well, that's a pretty valuable feedback, even though it's like, it's harsh, but you probably knew that beforehand. Like you spend your whole winter on a fingerboard and, you know, in your home wall in the garage, and you don't come out of that with fantastic technique.
yeah.
Whereas you said others could probably benefit a lot by doing strength training and like putting that into their routine. I mean, we see some of the best boulders and climbers in the world doing 8C plus boulder problems, and they can barely do a one arm or a one arm lock off. And then you have people at your local gym that boulder 7A and they can do 4 one arms and they can do a 90 degree lock off with 10 kilos. And it's like, you don't really need to improve that anymore, mate. I mean, everyone's different, but you need to do something else. If your goal is to perform better on a variety of climbing, if your goal is to be stronger in your local gym, then fine. You can keep on doing that. So it comes back to goals again.
I always think that it would be like, I always dream of this scenario, and I think like as an organization we're trying to kind of play our part in doing that and going down that route, that I would love to see a position where climbing had a set of really good, reliable, valid, repeatable performance profiling tests which were used across all the different parts of climbing. The sport's gone a really long way in the last, you know, 3 to 5 years in this physical aspect. But imagine if we had a really good performance profiling kit, toolkit for the psychological aspect of climbing, the technique, the movement economy. If you could start to build all of those together and then you had athlete A and you could line up all of those sections and you could look at all parts of the profile and you might sit there and go, it's just incredible, this person here who's coming top 10 in internationals, it's climbing really hard grades, but physically they're very poor on it. How on earth are they achieving that? And you can couple that with going, okay, this scenario of someone performing the top 10 with a weak physical profile only occurs if they're the top 1% in technique
and
whatever, you know, other things it might be. And that would be such a great position to be in.
It is, and now it's just mystic and magic and fun, and like you sit there as a coach or just an observer, even if it's only at your local gym, and you see someone, it's like, how can they do what they do? I mean, they should be able to hang on to these things, because I've tried it and I'm stronger physically, but they just piss on it compared to how I do it. So you try to like look at how do they position their body, how do they move, how is the, are they fluent in their movements, are they climbing fast, is it just the attitude, like do they just try harder? Like basically I think to boil it down to all these mystical magic factors would be really cool to get some numbers on and to see how they score. I don't know if we can get there, but it will be good to try.
Yeah, I definitely believe that it's possible, because at the moment, I think it, as coaches and those who have coached for many years, we just understand it through experience. We've watched a lot of athletes. We've been on the journey with them. So we've seen what their technique is like. We've seen what they're like with strategy. We know their mental game. So you've got a good intuition that when you work with people, you can kind of rank it in your head where you think they are roughly on those different parts of the profile. Yeah. But my logic is always, if a human brain can do that, it's just done that by putting lots of inputs in, mixing it around, applying that to experience, and then outputting something.
Yeah.
And so it's possible to do it. It's just, it'll take time.
Yeah. And then as coaches, we're prone to our own biases as well. So like, I know I have a movement pattern that I find like more stylish or more efficient or whatever in climbing. So I have an idea in my head how a move should look like. And then an athlete can perform that move in another way, which is way more efficient for them, which is like, nah, maybe you should try and do it this way instead. And then see that, well, that doesn't really work for you. And you try to watch the World Cups, you see the best climbers in the world, and it doesn't really make any sense trying to replicate how they move even. Like no one could climb like Ondra, and you have to be built very special to do the helix for the Slovenian teams. Like it's just, you have all this uniqueness. So you say you take all this input and you try to make some sense out of it, and you try to individualize it to your athlete or your client. So that's probably where all the magic lies. It's dispositionalism. How do all these dispositions work together?
Yeah.
Which is what makes it really fun. And maybe doing something like pseudoscience popular can actually bring that to the table to make people reflect a bit more on that performance consists of a variety of factors that all integrate together and work together. So I would say that people shouldn't really be disappointed or angry if they score a higher grade than they can actually climb. But take it as maybe a sign that you should try to train on and work on other factors.
Are you suffering from chronic disease? Or maybe you're trying to live to 120 and optimize your health. Either way, the Your Health, Your Story podcast is for you. My name's Casper Schultz, and I've been traveling the world meeting with top doctors and experts in medicine and health with amazing discoveries that are making the incurable curable. I decided I had to share these stories to empower others who are seeking solutions but just couldn't find them. So join us for weekly enlightening discussions on how to beat chronic disease and live an incredibly healthy life that you won't hear about elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to get some Q&As and let everyone who's on the live ask us some questions in a minute. So I'll let them populate I've got a little stream on the screen in front of me that I can kind of read out questions. But before, whilst I give people time to put those questions into us about the performance profiling and testing elements of it, I wanted to ask you in your experience as a coach, physiotherapist, working with national teams, really good athlete yourself as well, is if you were stuck in a room and you had, an hour or so to work with an athlete, where would you kind of put your money in terms of what you think are good, reliable, valid, repeatable tests if you had to make a sort of, you know, a selected choice on what you're going to do for some performance profiling? Where do you kind of put your money from what you've seen over the years?
Are we talking like straight physical performance or just everything?
It's physical performance, yeah. Just to keep it focused before we get.
Because that wouldn't be done in an hour. No, I would definitely do a finger test, a finger strength test.
Yeah.
So and I would do that very close to maximum, so maximum force. So it's like if it's 3 seconds or 5 seconds, doesn't make that much of a difference. I would just see how much force can they produce in a short amount of time.
Yeah. Any opinion on grip position?
I find, but that's probably because we're in Norway and we climb a lot on granite, that half crimp is a very very versatile grip position. Whereas if you climb in Frankenjura, you probably would try to do it on pockets. But I would, like, in my experience, if you perform well in half crimp, that seems very transferable to other grip positions as well.
Yeah.
So I would do that just to have a standard test. I would do that instead of the 3-finger open, just so you can get all 4 fingers in. So half crimp, weighted dead hangs. I would do a maximum pull-up test, as you do. A bit depending on the experience of the athlete, if you were to do 1, 2, or 5 reps. So, but then again, I would be more interested in how much force they can produce in a few number of reps, basically. Because I think that maximum strength is also an indicator on short-term endurance performance. So that would give me some answers. It's interesting to hear you say that with the long duration hangs, like the like 2 minutes dead hangs.
I was so disappointed.
Yeah.
I really need it to work.
Yeah, and it's like, I don't know if, like, one thing is hanging from a bar. That's a good starting point for people, maybe even to train, just to start to build some strength. But hanging from a 20 mil edge, I would thought it would correlate better to your level. So, like, if you could hang for 2 minutes on a 20 mil edge, I would, like, say, well, maybe we don't have to do this as much. If you can barely hang off it, then for 10 seconds, then that's something we need to work on. Because, I mean, one rep till exhaustion is still one max. Like, it's as much as you can do. You just use time as a variable instead of weight. So I would actually do the long duration hangs. Maybe I should reconsider after talking to you. But that would give me an idea of the profile, at least.
I'll have to go through all the old spreadsheets from like 2017.
Yeah.
I'll send them all over to you, and you can go and have a look at them and decide whether you want to carry on doing that bit.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen some very interesting things with both the long duration hangs and intermittent hangs. When you compare boulders to lead climbers, etc., and see, like, the force production of a boulder is so much higher, but it tends to drop so fast compared to the lead climbers, where they just maintain that steady curve for such a long time. So, like, at one point they'll meet. So it makes sense that the boulder will be able to do way harder moves to begin with, but then fatigue earlier. So you see that in the World Cup as well with the boulders. If they're forced to be on the wall for more than like 90 to 120 seconds, they seem to like start falling off more rapidly. Whereas the lead climbers, if they face all these spectacular boulder problems very early on, they're less suited to handle those. So I think you see that in competition climbing as well. So I think I would do a long hang just to see how do they perform. If they can't really add any weight, but they can hang on for a long time, then I wouldn't use time as a variable. I would try to use weight.
Yeah.
And that would probably take an hour to do that.
that's all you got.
Yeah. And and like I didn't mention core. I'm still not sure if we should test core. Maybe not even the way that we did with Magnus. I mean, he can hold a front lever for 15 seconds. So for him, it's fun. I can't fucking hold a front levers. I don't want that test to be in there at least. But I think it's hard to train core in a way that's specific to climbing, that tests that has that specificity and validity that makes up a good test. So, I mean, you could do all these hanging exercises. You could do L-sit, quarter front, half front, full front, the whole progression ladder. But if we can test that and say that it really correlates to how you climb, I'm not really sure. What's your thought?
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll come back to that because we'll answer some questions and then we'll talk about core. Yeah. Cool. I've definitely got some views on that for sure.
Cool.
I love chatting to you about this sort of stuff. It makes me
feel like, fun.
Why am I not doing this every day of the week, just talking about tests and data?
Yeah, we could do this. I mean, we're still in lockdown in Oslo, so I have plenty of time in the evenings.
such geeks.
Yeah. Okay. That's what my wife said.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Question number one here from, I think it's Jez. Do you think that hand-eye coordination tests would be appropriate for a performance profiling test?
No. but it depends, though. Like, what do you mean by a hand-eye coordination test? Like, if it were to catch a ball,
I'm not quite sure because I can't have a dialogue.
Catching a ball. I've coached climbers that can't really catch a ball, but they can dead point with millimeter precision. If it comes to eye-hand coordination on a single move to test, then yeah. But then you add dynamics into it and technique and all of these things. So it's not like just a straight eye-hand coordination test. It's like a movement test on dead points and dynamics.
Yeah.
But I think that's when you move from the world of physical factors and onto putting a client on the climbing wall and see how they move, and you get a pretty quick impression. Like if they're really static, don't move fluently, they want to lock everything, then I don't think that's eye hand coordination. It's more a technical variable that you should work on.
Yeah. Okay. Are there any tests that you've done over the years that correlated with performance that have surprised you, and anything that you've kind of collected data on with national teams or individuals where you've gone, I wasn't expecting that, or anything curious?
Mostly negative, right? You come up with all these ideas on like this should correlate, and you test it and it doesn't really make up. So like pure lock off strength, one arm. Can't really see how that correlates, even though I tested it. And that's strange because I feel that it correlates, like I'm improving my lock off strength, but I haven't seen that in athletes. Mm. It was basically when we started testing weighted dead hangs, I was really impressed by how much that could predict performance and level. I think what has surprised me a lot is, like I talked about earlier, when you compare maybe boys and girls or boulders and lead climbers, to see that difference in force output to begin with, and how one curve just drops really fast and one can just go on for ages. I see the same with power. So if you test, then you need more equipment though. If you test power till exhaustion, so say you have, you can use this force cell, right? And you clip it to your harness and you do a pull up as fast as you can and you get the force production. So that means how much speed can you generate in a pull up. And you try to do as many as you can and until the curve drops under a reference point that you preset, right? So you're not fatigued, but you're too fatigued to perform with that speed. To also see the difference between athletes that actually perform pretty similar and the different profiles. Like he is really, really explosive and can have massive power output. Whereas this guy can not produce the same amount of force that quickly, but he can just go on for ages and keep that curve flat. So these are like, more into the nitty gritty of trying to understand why some people can perform differently, but still on a similar level.
Yeah, I think I'd agree in some ways that some of the most interesting things that have come out of profiling have been the real kind of edge cases of people that are just so far off the spectrum, like really like a long way out from what you would think. But then you, of course, what if you dive deeper into it and actually then look at things around like movement skills or particularly like mindset as well. Yeah. I think they're like really, really unusual. Like, for example, there's a guy, well, there's two people that we've worked with, one being Alex Honnold and then another being a local Sheffield climber who's like one of the very, I hope he's not listening, but I'm going to call him old school because he is old school. but he is such a bold climber. Like his mind game in terms of climbing is like absolutely amazing. He's done some really, really seriously impressive stuff over the years. And it's almost hidden by the fact that he also has quite a hardcore job. And also he was almost before his time. I suspect if he was born now, he'd be like a real superstar. But if you looked at his performance profiling tests, him and Alex scored a very similar profile. And I was out running with him last year and I was joking as I was running along. I was like, you do realize there's only one person I've ever tested who have looked at the scores and gone, that looks very similar to Alex's and it's you. And then if I talk to you both about how you feel about things like fear and how you deal with committing circumstances and how much you're prepared to go to your margins, your limit, they're exactly the same. It's like listening to the same person, the way they communicate. And it really stood out to me, that whole thing of like, edge cases sometimes best describe the true potential for climbers and all humans.
Yeah. And it's like with those guys, you could say that, I mean, you could increase their strength. They could do like all the sport climbing, bouldering, training methods, and they would probably perform even better. Mm-hmm. But like maybe they don't really, maybe they're happy doing whatever they want to do. Like maybe we shouldn't encourage Honnold to build strength to free solo something harder. But like that would be going the other way from what most people do, right? That they test the physical part and it's so much easier to train the physical bit, like so much compared to all the other stuff. Yeah. And I think there's still a lot of surprises when it comes to testing, but I think like it seems like we're getting on some common ground on what are the key performance factors when it comes to at least the physical bits.
Yeah, at least we're getting some vague agreement.
Yeah, some vague agreement. Yeah.
What do you think? Oh, I just lost the question, but it was here. How do you feel about Goodhart's law? And this whole phenomenon that we see that if we have metrics that we create in performance profiling, and then essentially, especially if they become well known, is those metrics then become an end or a means to an end that people will then pursue those metrics, and then that will have an effect back into performance profiling. What's your thoughts on this? Because I've definitely tackled this one a few times.
Yeah, I mean, it's a self-feeding loop, isn't it? I think existentially there's a problem when you invent something and you follow it, and it's like in climbing there's not that many researchers doing this on a full-time basis, so obviously you get very biased to your own work and you feed that back. And especially like in medicine and physiotherapy, I've seen this over and over again. Like you do your research in a silo and then you keep on just building in that silo and you don't really see what's going on outside. And then if your work is popular and it gains followers and gains reputation, then you have more people doing more of the same instead of questioning it. So then you end up with loads of people performing better on tests that we maybe don't even know if they correlate well. Just like you said with the 20 mil lung hang, like if you were to follow that and take ownership to that test, like this is the test, this is the 9C plus test, like, and you follow that, we're only human, right? So it would be a self-feeding loop that could be hard to get out of, because you have to go back to the start which is hard when you've invested a lot of time in it. So I don't think that's any, I think that's the same in sports science and medicine and physiotherapy research, all the same. And we kind of see it, like a good example would be ACL ruptures in the knee. So in Norway, at least handball is pretty big. So everyone rupture their ACL in the knee and they get surgery. And we have all these tests and milestones and return to sport parameters that they have to meet before they go back. So strength tests, hop tests, everything. And then that's been building up over years and years and years. And they still re-rupture their ACL, or they rupture on the other side. And when you look at it, it seems that like fear is a stronger predictor if they come back compared to the metrics. If you move the test venue to inside the goal field on a handball pitch where they actually got injured, the test score drops dramatically compared to what it is in a lab. So I think what's hard with this loop is that it's hard to step out of it. Like, you can't really see yourself in that position. And that's why maybe it's good that we challenge ourselves more to put something popular out there for discussion and get feedback and criticism and evolve on that background instead.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answered the question, but...
No, it's great. And it's actually really interesting to hear your perspective also from, you know, operating outside of climbing as well and as a physiotherapist. And it's certainly something that we've talked about quite a bit. And we have Remus, who works and has been with us right from the start of Lattice, and has always worked on the statistical models, and he's a mathematician. And every now and again, probably like once a year, I'll bring it up with him and go, Remus, can we just talk about this again, please? I'm a little bit concerned again. Can we just go through everything here? And it's essentially an unavoidable issue, and it's down to us as practitioners to work with it, understand the ramifications of that, how it might affect our findings, how it affects our battery of tests and how we select for them, how much we review our data models and go back and say, well, have things changed? So do we need to look at the models themselves again? Yeah. The climbing population evolves. So it's just, it's one of those things you like, be aware of it. Don't just go, don't like it.
Yeah, I know. And I think that's like, especially with social media as well, that you come into this bubble that we very rarely step out of it. And that's both in sports science and in physiotherapy. So like everything you see just adds to your own bias, and you think that this is great and this is the way it should go. And I think that we have a role there to just step back and look at it from the outside for a bit and hear other people's perspective. And I think we see that with the physical bit of climbing as well, because it's like it shows off better on social media to do the physical bits of climbing. Like, it looks better. It's easier to train. It's easier to explain. Whereas I'm not really sure if 3.5 milliseconds difference in power output is really where people should put their emphasis in their own training. But when that's everything you see, if you're new to the sport, then obviously you would think that this is the most important part, which is also the challenge with calling something the 9C test and putting it out there to 1 million climbers with very various backgrounds. It's like, this is not the truth. This is one small part of a puzzle. So maybe it should come when you do something like that. Maybe it should come with some sort of demand that you go out and explain it afterwards, but then you wouldn't be able to do anything else in your day.
I know. Yeah. I mean, like when I saw that test come out and I saw Magnus do it, I was like, I almost put my head in my hands just going, oh no, now this has got even more broad. There's going to be so much more of the climbing population going to do this. This is going to result in so many more questions. And in a way, that was one of the things that really catalyzed me into thinking, I've just got to go and talk to Stian and Martin, because we're going to get so much back from this. I want this discussion and interview podcast to be a source that people can go to. And if they want to like actually understand the context and the nuance behind these kind of things, even though it's cool that, you know, there's the 9C test or whatever kind of performance profiling, like just basic dead hand tests you can do, is that there is also a practice behind it and there's a coaching expertise behind it. And it's trying to explain how you use that in a real world example.
Yeah, because you have all these factors that work together and everything is depending on context as well. And even if we had like all the solid data to compare, like I said, with the Premier League, where you have the physical data, so you could actually compare, then it would also be a question like when do you do the measurements of these tests? Like if you, we discussed a bit earlier on like what's a good test and also what's a good time to do these tests on. Like if you do a test preseason, you're probably weaker than you are before going into competition season. That's sort of like a baseline. You know that you will improve. And then you test during the season to measure progress. And then you test maybe preseason, but you never test like the day before the World Champs. Like that's when you're prime. That's where your maximum capacity is. So like you won't have a track and field athlete going on a 60 meter dash the day before the final heat of the Olympics, where that would be the real time. And it's the same with us climbers, that we don't do these tests at a time where we can say that this is my absolute maximum. So when we say that, if you score this, then you can climb this grade if you have the best technique in the world on a maximum day, then like the test scores will vary a lot. Like everyone who has done a dead hang training protocol know that 90% of one RM is very different from day to day, just during the same week. It shouldn't, but it is, especially what time of day. Like I do my dead hangs in the cellar, as you do. If I do that at 10 o'clock in the morning, I have to deload more on a one-arm dead hang. If I do it in the afternoon, if I haven't eaten, like all of these things, they add up to make a test result very variable and also very hard to compare across, like compared to other athletes. Yeah. So I think that's important to bring to the table as well.
Yeah, actually, that kind of brings us to, I think, probably one of the really important things that both you and I talked about before, you know, chatting this evening, is that the performance profiling toolkit or, you know, methodology can be so useful in terms of this individual tracking process. And you can actually have a test kit or, you know, a battery of tests, which may actually have not the best correlation with, you know, the matrix, the table, whatever it is. But as long as there's a degree of validity, reliability, repeatability, and you can use those with an athlete in relatively controlled settings at the right times across the seasons and years, this is actually a really powerful tool still.
And it is.
More climbers in the world, I feel like they should get this into their head, that this is almost like the more powerful part of it rather than the, am I a good climber or not?
Yeah. And also is also very motivational to have that test battery. I mean, obviously you test yourself every time you do a physical exercise. Like you will always measure your rate of perceived effort doing the same hang as you did the week before. Like, all right, today it felt easier, et cetera, et cetera. But from my experience, if you put a test date in any athlete's calendar or in your own calendar, you would be psyched. Like you would be a bit more psyched to perform that day. So you pull a bit harder on that session. So you get, like, compared to a normal training session, you actually get a better training session and you get some good measurements on like, all right, if I prepare properly, then this is what I can actually do on a good day. And to have that like every second or third month throughout the year could be a good tool to see if you have a progression over time, or if it's just flat, then maybe you should do something else. If it goes down, try to find a reason why it goes down. So it's a very important tool for measuring and for motivating, I think.
Yeah. I think I said this to you the other day as well, is that one of the earliest papers that I read about performance profiling was talking about the use of the performance profiling toolkits to coaches and to athletes. And this study had shown that the two top ranking things, the kind of value items back to the athlete, one of them was it was a highly motivating thing. So it often kind of like just distilled down where they are now and what do they need to get onto. It's almost like a day one thing. It's going, the test is done.
Yeah.
Results. Right. Let's get on with stuff. Even if it said you're stronger than we thought you were, you were fitter than what you thought you were. Brilliant. Now we get on with something else. Or the other way around. It's a sort of, it's a starting point and it's a massive motivator for people.
Yeah.
And that's like one of the things why I'm always been so committed to using those back with the athletes that we work with, whether it's someone that is, you know, coming to us from a climbing their first 7A to their first 9A. It's a really, really good starting point. And I think a lot of people, again, like underestimate how useful that is, whether they're working with a coach or just self-training, self-coaching from a book, from home. Such a good starting point.
It is. And that's like the easier you can make these test batteries, the more likely it is that it will actually get done.
Yeah.
So like we discussed this earlier as well. Like we've been fooling around with all these measurement units and obviously they're really good at measuring stuff. Like, and some people are really good at measuring stuff, but if it ends up with it not being done, then we should try to make it simpler. And that's the same thing we see in rehab, basically. Like we're in sports science, we're privileged to work with pretty highly motivated people. Like they pay money to get stronger in something meaningless as climbing. Whereas when you have patients, then a lot of patients, they don't even like to train. They don't like exercise. So it doesn't matter if you have the best exercise protocol in the world with the most fancy name or fancy equipment, it won't get done. So basically maybe you just end up with telling them to do one thing during the day, go for a walk or lift the weight off the ground one time a day, and that could be it. Like you just have to make it get done. And I think simple tests and measuring progression is a very simple tool to structuralize your training just a bit more. And most climbers need that structure to improve, like in all sport.
Yeah, and whatever it's tackling to go forward as well, whether it's, you know, looking at the number of times that they actually get outdoors versus always being stuck into the gym and doing something that they find easy at the moment, but actually they find it quite challenging going outside and they're poor at standing on their feet and they're not very good at reading rock and moving on it. Even just structuring your year and saying, last year, I went outside 10 times across the entire year. And now you go, actually, I would like to achieve a good 50 days outside a year. How am I going to structure that? What sort of, you know, way am I going to formalize that? Even that is really effective. And it sounds so like basic, like how would that ever be effective? But actually, it just comes down to organization and intention.
Yeah. And people don't like it being simple. I mean, people would like to read off the rate of force development curve and get another kit to their basement and everything. And so like the simple solution, they work really well, but it's not so fancy. It's like, it's hard to sell, which is strange. Like it's harder to sell a simple product than a complex one, but that's maybe just who we are as humans.
Yeah.
But yeah, I totally agree. And to see what you've done in the past as well, I've had this discussion with athletes that refuse to write a diary, like a training journal, which is like, well, this is your choice, but when is the last time you were at the top of your game? Two years ago. What did you do? I don't remember. Well, that's a fucking shame then. Like you should know what you've been doing. And so you could go back a couple of years and see not only your progression, but what were all the like tweaks and different bits that you put together at that particular time. I've been wondering with that myself in my own training, like why did I perform that well that spring? I shouldn't have, but I did. So I guess you've had the same as well. Like there are periods in your life where you don't have time to train as much as you want to, but still you come out and you perform better than you expected. So why was that? Was it just the joy of being outside again, or have you rested more? So all of these things are good for measuring.
Yeah, for sure. Like I did a period where I was I'm a parent. I've got two relatively young kids.
Second that.
Yeah. And like a few years back, I did some tracking of my sleep in relation to my performance, because I wanted to just like, in a way, know once and for all what happened if I went over a period of 100 days or so and actually just recorded roughly what kind of sleep I had and then how did I perform in training sessions or rock outside. And I found absolutely zero correlation, almost a positive correlation to my best days out were after some of my very, very worst nights of sleep, which led to me in the end to the conclusion that I'd set expectations very low as a result of feeling totally knackered. And actually that led to me the conclusion of actually a lot of my performance could actually be limited by expectation. That's a head thing. So when I let go of that expectation, because I had such terrible sleep, I just flowed. Yeah. And I had a great time outside. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. And it took me 100 days to get to it.
Yeah, but sometimes you need that. And maybe that's with the physical test as well. Like sometimes you need something quantifiable to say something about where you are in space and then be able to navigate from that. And I've been thinking about the same as well, because I have two kids as well. And there was a period where you had to maximize every single day you went out. And by maximizing, meaning performing. So there was a period where I ended up performing, but it wasn't very joyful. Like every day was more a stress. So you do the things that you came to do and then you went home, and it didn't really add that magic and that value you're searching for. So like, why is that? Then suddenly you just go out to perform instead of go out and climbing. So you climb shit, but you can still perform. So try to switch that to the other direction and actually just appreciate the time being outside more. Mm-hmm. And for a period of, because you need that try hard attitude, but for a period of time, it was quite good to let that go. And maybe not perform as well, but just to get back that joy of being outside and climbing and doing whatever it is that makes you happy when you're outside.
Yeah, which is really important.
Yeah, I mean, I think I over 25 years of climbing, I think I can think of like 5 times in my climbing career, I'm really, really satisfied with myself. So like if you go out and set the standards very high all the time, then you're probably bound to be a depressed person in a while, a disappointed person. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, one more question from me, and I think it's an interesting one to kind of sort of wrap up this chat and interview and everything like that, and is around where we feel that the kind of the future of coaching and training and performance is going. Because, you know, you're, as I said, like a physiotherapist, a coach, an athlete yourself. You know, you've written this amazing book. You've got another one coming out really soon. You're really involved with this part of the development of the sport and the industry. So I always think it's really interesting to see where people see things going over the next 5 years.
Yeah, I definitely see climbing being more and more professionalized, good and bad. So you see it on the competition circuit. The teams are more professional. They have more coaches, more medical teams. It's coming more money into the sport. So we get a bit more research. I'm torn a bit between how I grew up with climbing as something that was different from all the other sports. And that's why I came to climbing. And now where people come into the sport to perform and to go to the Olympics, for instance, do that elite focus take away the magic of climbing? I was really torn in that dilemma when I took the coaching job for the National Federation. And it doesn't really, I kind of surprised myself by seeing that. I think a lot of the magic is still there, even though you aim to perform all the time. I've seen people crying at the crag for not doing their route, and I've seen people crying at the crag for crying at a competition for not delivering. So I think it's like you find the joy in whatever you're pursuing. But I think that coaching will go in the way of professionalizing, structuralizing, building more training plans. I think climbing will attract coaches and athletes from other sports where you have a good understanding of the physical bit, the biological bit, maybe even the mechanical bit, but maybe lacking on the technical, tactical, mental part of climbing. So I think the trend of increased focus on physical factors will just continue. So we'll see some very, very strong climbers over the next years. And then I think that the competition, how the competitions are set now, probably saves the technical bit, because all the youngsters coming into the comp scene now, they're being more challenged on the technical bit than the physical bit, which I think is great. So that might save it a bit, but I'm not worried or concerned. I just think that we will continue down this road of measuring stuff and doing all the quantifiable things, which takes a bit of the focus away from the technical, tactical, mental bit.
Yeah. I always feel that sports go through these evolutionary cycles where you see for around, it feels like 10 years or so at a time, a real focus on a certain kind of part of the sport or discipline within the sport. And that's the thing. And yeah. I almost feel like you can categorize it by just looking at the front covers of magazines in climbing over the last 50 years. And it went through that cycle of, you know, like everything that had the biggest kudos was, you know, sport climbing. And then everything that had the biggest kudos was bouldering.
Yeah.
It feels like now we're in this middle of this period where we have transferred away from those 10 years of very heavy bouldering focus to now competitions, indoor gyms, training aspect. And I think it'll cycle out that again, and it'll come back around once we have a big part of the sort of top section of the pyramid who are all operating at a very similar standard and trying to gain the next position on top of the other 100 people at the top is so hard to do that it becomes appealing to just say, well, actually, I'll take all the skills I have now and I'll move it into big wall climbing, for example. Yeah. And suddenly they leap to top of the world, number one, in 6 months, and then the kudos suddenly travels to a different area.
Yeah, that's probably true. Like when you see the magazines over the last couple of years that have come to life, like Gym Climber and Route Setting magazines, and so you see the focus going to competitions. And I mean, the first competition I went to as a coach was in 2011 at the Youth World Championships. And now I still see some of the youth athletes from that competition 10 years later performing in the World Cup, which is really cool. But like how the circuit has grown and grown and grown just over that decade is pretty massive. And I think that competitions will drive outdoor performance. So we'll probably still see harder grades in the future. But I also think to push grades beyond the likes of Ondra and Magos now, it will take more than to just do the competitions. It's like you have to be a certain kind of athlete and a climber to go that direction. And I think personally that you might need that competition training cycle bit, like the whole structured part beyond outdoor climbing. I think you would probably need that if you want to push standard outside as well. I think the days are gone where you can just be a very good outdoor climber and do the hardest routes in the world. I think you need to do more. So, and I think there's coming more and more people in to help doing that, like more and more professional people trying to help, but not only elite athletes, but also in every local gym would probably have personal trainers and more skilled people to work there.
No, for sure. I think I could just keep going on this for a really long time.
We could just take off record and then keep on going.
Yeah, keep going. I mean, the good thing is we've already got another interview podcast planned for talking about your book and getting Martin on board as well.
Yeah.
About kind of general climbing, coaching and training, just taking it way broader away from performance profiling and everything like that. So I think that'd be really cool.
That would be great for us as well. Like we didn't really see a physical test exploding in popularity. It was good because it raised all these questions, and it also sort of explains why we built our book the way we did, starting the book with the chapter of technique and also trying to include all these other performance factors when it comes to tactics and mental parts and try to supplement that, because like all the training books that you read are very good on the physical part. And I'm not really sure if that's like for average Jane and Joe climber, if they really need to dwell down into the biology of physical factors when there's so much else to explore. And maybe a test like the 9C test was something to bring all of this to the table. So I would love to chat more about that.
Yeah, no, that'd be totally amazing. And actually, for anyone who's watching or listening, including everyone who's on the Instagram live, where's the best place for them to be able to find your book and find more information about you? So, you know, like on social media, and where can they go to find your book?
They can go to Vertebrate Publishing. The website, they're the ones helping us selling the book in England. Amazon UK sells it. Whereas for our own websites and social media, we're so bad at that. So we don't even have a have an international website. If you want to see what I'm doing in my life and climbing, you can find me at Instagram with Stian Kristoffersen. And Martin at Martin Mobrotten. As of now, we're basically just diving and skiing since all the gyms are closed. So, but I can put some videos up of me training in my cellar doing dead hangs.
I mean, it's not like you're short of very good quality rock in Norway. It's just amazing. I love it.
Yeah, it's just that now it's minus 17 degrees in Oslo. So that's a bit cold. I'm getting too old, I guess. I see people go out and I was like, no, I'll go down to the basement instead. Yeah. No, but we have some amazing rock. So do you. I've only been one day bouldering in Sheffield. So the plan, like the basic plan of publishing the book in England, was to have an excuse to go over to Stanage more often. And then COVID happened. So we have to come visit, and that's, speaking of the pandemic and the future of climbing and things going in circles, then actually the pandemic coming in March, closing all the gyms for 3 months, I've never seen so many people outside climbing. And even though the weather was fantastic, I know at least half of those people would be stuck in a gym. So like if we do a pandemic like every decade, then we would probably get a lot of the gym rats more outside improving their technique.
Yeah, it's good for the climbing population. It's just going to take the pain of it.
I know. And then it's good to have your secret spots as well. So, I mean, we're still grumpy old men, aren't we? So we tried to be more alone on the crag. Yeah. There was a time 25 years ago when we could do that. No, but cool.
Well, thanks so much, Stian. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll chat again very soon. Everyone listening, we'll put the links to Stian's and Martin's book down in the writing below, any of our posts, and you can find them on social media. We'll put their tags on there as well. So, we will see you all again very soon.